Welcome to Elevate Your Energy Radio. This is episode number 85, Methylation and Your Health, Understanding Epigenetics and the Power of Personalized Medicine with Dr. Erica Oberg. I'm really excited for the show tonight. First of all, because it's my first podcast back since my interview with Mark Sklar on Supercharging Your Fertility, which was actually my most popular show ever. So thank you for that. If you are new to this podcast, welcome. My name is Evelyn, and my goal of this show is to share the best in women's health, functional and integrative medicine and nutrition, and help you elevate your energy. You can find me at elevateyourenergy.com, Elevate Your Energy on Facebook, and I have a guide on my website for you to download, 5 days to More Energy. I also have more than 80 episodes of the show that you can listen to online or on your podcast app. So whether you're in your car on the way to work or on a walk, you can listen to various topics related to women's health. I also got a new microphone with a pop filter, so I hope the sound quality is better as well. I'm also excited for the show because I've become very interested in the fields of epigenetics, nutrigenomics, learning about genetic SNPs, about MTHFR, which you may have heard about and which I did do a show on a while back. And don't worry, we'll go over some of these definitions in just a moment, but it really is a growing field. There are genetic companies popping up all the time, especially here in San Diego, where Eric and I both live. And we've mapped the human genome, and now we're looking for patterns and trying to figure out what all of this means. So the research is still very young, and what's cool is later on in the show, we'll actually get to hear about an opportunity for you to participate in a research study related to this. So my guest is Dr. Erica Oberg. She is a researcher, physician, friend, and just an all-around great person to be around and learn from. So I think she's perfect for this topic. She got her BA in anthropology from the University of Colorado, her doctorate of naturopathic medicine from Bastyr University, and a master's of public health from the University of Washington. She completed her residency at the Bastyr Center for Natural Health and fellowship training at the Health Promotion Research Center at the University of Washington. She's currently in private practice as a naturopathic doctor with Guarneri Integrative Health at Pacific Pearl La Jolla, which is a beautiful facility, and she provides research consultation in the fields of nutrition, health promotion, and natural products. She has published more than 35 peer-reviewed articles and has contributed to numerous medical textbooks internationally. She was also on faculty at Bastyr University for nearly 10 years, including serving as a clinic director. She has taught at both naturopathic and conventional medical schools in the divisions of naturopathic medicine, nutrition, and public health. Her research has included patient perspectives on nutrigenomics, healthy aging, and chronic disease management by NDs. She has studied the role of practitioners' own health behaviors in the delivery of clinical health promotion, finding that when doctors practice what they preach, patients benefit too. And when not contributing to the advancement of integrative medicine, Dr. Oberg promotes her own health. You'll find her cooking veggie-filled, gluten-free recipes, playing with her dog on the beach, and learning to surf. Hi, Erica.
Hello there. How are you, Evelyn?
I'm doing well today. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm great. My pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk with you this evening.
Yeah. So I'd love to start by hearing about how you got into medicine, first of all, and research, and then now how you got interested in genetics.
Well, you know, the dual roles that I wear as a clinical researcher as well as a clinician, I think really shape the way that I approach patient care. You know, and we as a researcher, it's really important that we stay grounded in what really matters to our patients and what their perspectives are and what their priorities are. And as a clinician, I think it's really important to stay grounded in the research and appreciate exactly what the data show so that we know what we can expect and we can tell patients what they can expect in terms of the outcomes of their health. So I really value the combination of the lens of both research and clinical practice, and I've been doing both for about 15 years now. What really has transformed my practice over the last, say, 3 to 4 years has been the study of epigenetics. It's really just given me such a new opportunity to add incredible precision to my clinical practice and really help my patients not only understand their health, but understand what they can expect in terms of outcomes, in terms of evidence-based medicine. It's super exciting.
So what exactly is epigenetics? And then how do you think that this field is, you said it has changed your practice. Can you maybe expand on how it has done this and how it can expand the practice of medicine in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we use the word epigenetics, we're really talking about the science of understanding how the environment changes the way our genes express. Now, we all probably remember that we have 23 chromosomes, and we get half of those from our mother and half of those from our father. And those chromosomes are involved. They're essentially the recipe by which we make all of our cells and our proteins and everything that happens in our body, from the enzymes to hormones to making new muscle cells and brain cells, etc. All of that is programmed in our genes. The genes write the recipe. Now, what we used to think was that our genetics was our destiny. And what we now know is that our genes turn on and off in response to the environment surrounding them. And when we're talking about epigenetics, what we're really interested in is the cellular environment. And by and large, the cellular environment is defined by nutrition, right? Our cells and the DNA inside of our cells is constantly in a bath of nutrients, different vitamins and different minerals, different raw materials that make our different genes turn on and off. And so the science of epigenetics is really the study of how our environment, both nutritionally and to some degree behaviorally and environmentally, turns our genes on and off. And so when we understand this, we can really take a new perspective on our patients, both in terms of what their recipe is, and then the epigenetics and understanding the environment tells us more about what we can expect when we finally bake the cake, so to speak, the quality of the ingredients that go in. When I talk to my, I'll just give you a little analogy here. When I talk to my patients about epigenetics, I often tell them that their genes are the recipe, and epigenetics is the ultimate cake that we bake from it. So we all know that a cake will turn out differently if we use good fresh eggs versus ones that have been in the refrigerator for weeks, if we use that high quality chocolate rather than the generic low cocoa powder chocolate, right? So epigenetics is really the study of that final product and how we influence the final cake, irregardless of what the recipe or the genetics are.
I like that. So, how do genes get expressed? Like, how do they actually turn on and off?
That's a good question. It gets a little bit technical, but I'll try to keep it at kind of a high level. So I'm sure everybody can visualize that double helix in their mind, those two strands of DNA winding around each other. And if we take that microscopic zoom in, what we'll see is that those strands of DNA wind around little balls called histones. And when those histones open, then the DNA can be read and turned into a protein or whatever else we need to make it in our body. And if that histone, that little ball is not opened, then the DNA stays really tightly wound up and we can't read it, and thus we can't make a new protein. And what we've discovered is that the thing that makes the histones open or close is a process called methylation, moving a simple carbon either on or off of that gene. And so the exciting thing about epigenetics is that we now know that there are a number of genes that are involved in methylation. And when we understand that, we can really impact a patient's health by helping them optimize that process.
That was an awesome description. Definitely could visualize that. I feel like we hear it so many times and it just doesn't always click, but you explained that really well. I want to go over a few more definitions before we continue. Another term that we hear these days is nutrigenomics. How is that different from epigenetics?
Nutrigenomics, it's a term that we use when we're really talking about, that nutritional bath, that nutritional environment that surrounds our DNA. So the practice of nutrigenomics is really about changing that nutritional environment. literally bathing your DNA in different nutrients, for example, methylated B vitamins instead of inactivated B vitamins. And when we change that nutritional environment, we literally change our expression of DNA.
And then what is a SNP? You hear that genetic SNPs spelled SNP. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so a SNP stands for a single nucleotide polymorphism. And we talk about these in contrast to major chromosomal abnormalities. So most of us have heard about things like Down syndrome. You know, this is classically what we have thought about in terms of genetic problems in the past. And these are major genetic problems that happen at the level of an entire chromosome. Now, a SNP is a single nucleotide polymorphism. That means just one little base pair in your DNA can have a change. Literally, it can be as simple as an arginine being changed to a cysteine. And when we have that little tiny amino acid change, even though it's a super small change, it changes the function of that DNA, and then it changes the protein that it creates. And the science of epigenetics is really about how those little tiny changes occur, and we can measure those when we test people's SNPs and their genetics, and then how we can affect positive outcomes by changing the environment, specifically the nutritional environment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. So you kind of gave us a brief definition of methylation, and I think when I ask you about this next one, you can expand on that a little bit, but I think the most common genetic SNP related to methylation that everybody's talking about now is MTHFR, or methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. So why is it so relevant? And it seems like everybody has this, and it's implicated in so many health issues. So can you talk about what it is, and also, like, is that really the be-all, end-all that people are making it to be?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It certainly has gotten the most attention, both from researchers and certainly in the media.
Mm-hmm.
The MTHFR is ultimately an enzyme, and like every other enzyme, it's controlled by a gene. The gene has the same name in this situation. That's not always the case. So we talk about the MTHFR gene, and like any gene that potentially has variations on its single nucleotide polymorphisms, different polymorphisms, we can have what we call the wild type, or the pair of bases that we have had for, you know, thousands of years in our genetic evolution, or we can have mutations or changes in that. And so what we're seeing today, and we are seeing this happen with more and more frequency, I see far more mutations in my millennials than I do in my geriatric patients.
Hmm.
But people can have a small change in their MTHFR, for example, their C677C gene changes to a C677T, and that change in that base pair changes the function of the enzyme. And in the case of MTHFR, this is getting a little technical, but bear with me here. In the case of MTHFR, that changes how easily you convert dietary folate or folic acid that you might get in a supplement into the active form, the methylfolate, which we need to put into many different methylation reactions in our cellular biochemistry.
And if so many people have the mutation, then is it really that abnormal?
It's not really a question of whether it's abnormal, you know, commonly abnormal or not. It's a question of optimal health. And does somebody have their methylation pathways, which then program our DNA repair, how we make new DNA, how we clear out toxic byproducts like homocysteine or excess hormone levels or other types of things. Having MTHFR polymorphisms or SNPs really impacts how efficiently we do that. We could say something like obesity or overweight, which now affects 60% of the population, that's clearly no longer abnormal, but I think we would all agree that that's not necessarily an optimal thing.
Absolutely. And what are some of the other issues right now, according to the research that's out there, that MTHFR can be related to?
Probably the thing that originally hit the attention of scientists was the critical role of folic acid in neural tube development. And back, 20, 30 years ago, we used to have much, much higher rates of neural tube defects or spina bifida. And that was because women were really, really low in folic acid before they knew they were pregnant in those first couple weeks of pregnancy. And because of that deficit in folic acid, they weren't able to methylate. They weren't able to make synthesize proper DNA. And those fetuses weren't able to synthesize proper DNA and thus finish closing the neural tube. And so this became evident to scientists, and this is what led to enriching the entire population's food supply, breakfast cereals and breakfast additives, with folic acid. And as a result, we've seen neural tube deficits decrease in the United States. Now, what we know since then is that MTHFR polymorphisms and folic acid deficiency and the subsequent increases in things like homocysteine go far beyond just neural tube deficits. They have led to increases in cardiovascular risk, increases in a metabolite called homocysteine, which is inflammatory and increases cardiovascular disease independent of of your cholesterol levels and otherwise. We've seen associations in the literature of MTHFR with higher rates of depression, with higher rates of cancer, with a wide number of things. And in our research, we've seen associations with MTHFR associated with a much broader range of conditions in pretty much every organ system that you can imagine. And we think the huge range in symptoms that we see associated with MTHFR polymorphisms is because of its critical role in making and repairing DNA. And so we need new DNA in every organ system, from our skin to our digestion to our brain health to our heart health to our hormone health. And so it's not surprising that problems in methylation impact every organ system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I'll never forget, I was at a conference and there was a nurse there who worked at a cancer center, and they said that they test all of their patients for it. And she said every single one of their cancer patients had one of the MTHFR mutations.
Fascinating. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I know that there are some other genetic SNPs that are frequently tested along with MTHFR, and some of these aren't as well known, but I kind of follow what everybody's talking about online. And so I would love to go through some of these. Maybe you can just give maybe just like a one or two sentence explanation of what these are. But then what I'd really like to get to is like, what does this mean and how are they related to each other? So I'm talking about SNPs like COMT or COMT or MTR, MTRR, CBS, VDR. What do these all mean?
I know it quickly turns into alphabet soup, doesn't
yes.
it? I think for people who are just becoming introduced to this area of science and starting to appreciate, I think there are kind of two or three major concepts that people can focus on. MTHFR is not the only gene that's involved in methylation and the recycling of methionine and homocysteine. MTR, MTRR, those are some of the other key ones that are involved there. And so when we run somebody's genetics and look at an entire panel, such as the one offered by Epigenetics Rx, which gives us a nice snapshot of that, we can really understand not just the major places where those changes can happen, such as with MTHFR, but we can understand some of the minor breakdowns in methylation, such as MTR, MTRR, some of those other genes. Now, all of those are the critical pieces involved in how we use folate and B12 in the recycling of homocysteine. Again, remembering that we're talking about biochemical processes inside the cell, and ultimately we want to make sure we're recycling all of our methionine and homocysteine and keeping that cycle moving, because if we don't, we end up with toxic buildups of homocysteine, which is going to cause problems, and we're not going to end up with enough methyl donors in order to repair and make new DNA. So that's kind of the major piece of it. But there's a number of other SNPs that interplay. Did you have particular ones that you were curious about understanding?
Yeah, but I just want to go back for a second because I realize you've said homocysteine a couple times, and we didn't really define what that is. And then you also said methyl donor. So I just want to make sure we don't lose anybody. So can you explain what those are?
Absolutely. Thanks for those questions. It does quickly become very, very complicated. So homocysteine we consider it a non-protein amino acid. Basically, it's a byproduct that's synthesized in the process of recycling methionine, which is a key amino acid. And by taking the methyl group on and off, off of the methionine, the byproduct ends up being homocysteine. And so usually that gets recycled, and we just keep the process going by using B vitamins such as methylfolate and methylcobalamin to keep the recycling going. If we don't, then we get a toxic buildup of homocysteine, which we call hyperhomocysteinemia. And that is that chemical, that byproduct, is inflammatory. And so it causes endothelial injury. It causes injury to the level of cells inside the blood vessels. And that's what increases the risk of cardiovascular disease.
And then you also said methyl donor.
Yeah. So methylation is the process of moving what we call a methyl group, or a complete carbon, from one molecule to another, or from one amino acid to another. So the way that we recycle methionine, homocysteine is recycled back into methionine, is that the vitamin B12 makes that donation of the methyl to the homocysteine, thus turning it back into methionine. It's helpful to have a graphic for this. So anybody who's trying to really wrap their brain around it, I would encourage them to do a Google search or some other for methionine recycling pathways, and they'll be able to see those circular processes by which one is turned into the other, and all of the cofactors or the B vitamins that we need to make that process happen.
So you asked which SNPs I want to talk about. So that led me to another question, because I actually have a genetic report of my own up on my computer right now. And I know that some of the, what is the RS number? What does that mean? Because not all of those are necessarily relevant, right? Or at least we don't know yet about all of them.
Yeah, so the RS number is what scientists use to avoid all of the confusion of talking about, you know, the six versions of, for example, the six versions of MTHFR that somebody might have, right, between C677 polymorphisms and 1298 polymorphisms, between people having the wild type and mixed types and homozygous mutated types. There's a lot of variation. So each one of those variants is assigned an RS number, and that's basically, it's like the, the grocery store bar tag of that particular genetic combination. And so that enables scientists to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples when we talk about things. And it's true, there are a lot of genetic variations that either don't mean much because they code for a very small supportive protein, perhaps, or we just don't know what they do. Mm-hmm. So when we, for people who are doing their own homework, or for doctors who are trying to interpret exhaustive data from like a 23andMe report or something like that, it's important to know the RS number so that you don't get lost in the weeds and you're able to pull out the SNPs that we know matter and we can ignore the ones that just haven't panned out in terms of seeing a significance in human health.
So the ones that I'd love for you to expand on a little bit, and I won't share the RS numbers now because I want to talk kind of generally, but I have some homozygous mutations in COMT or COMT, in MAOA, in MAOB, and in MTRR. Can you talk about some of those and what they mean?
Yeah, sure. So COMT and the MAOs are particularly interesting ones. Those ones are more involved in how we process and metabolize the raw materials for neurotransmitters. There's a fantastic article published, I think it was in 2013, in the New York Times, in their Sunday magazine. Anybody who's interested in a great layperson read, I would encourage you to Google New York Times COMT and pull up that study. It's a great report. And the interesting thing about COMT, it stands for catecholmethyltransferase, and it's how we metabolize our catecholamines, or those stress-related neurotransmitters that we used to call adrenaline. Now we call it epinephrine and norepinephrine, and a couple other ones, dopamine and a few other ones. But whether it's not necessarily that one or the other form is good or bad, it's that different ones are appropriate under different circumstances. So people are either fast or slow metabolizers of those neurotransmitters. And so, for example, if you are a fast metabolizer, then that means you're going to clear out those stress hormones really quickly. So that's a good thing on a day-to-day basis. You're not going to be under high stress. But if you are, say, facing a fight-or-flight situation, and that might be a deadline at work or a test, then you may want to be able to perform better under stress. And so if you have the opposite polymorphism, you actually thrive under stress and perform better. But if you have the other one, then you get overwhelmed under stress and you get flooded with excess neurotransmitters and you don't do well. So the people who have that polymorphism tend to do better on a day-to-day basis. And it's interesting, we sometimes talk about these as the warriors versus the warriors, right? Those who thrive under stress versus those who thrive in the day-to-day planning circumstances. So that the New York Times article is a fun one because it goes through students who are taking the SAT and why some students have such a hard time with tests like SATs and the other students just breeze through them like it's nothing.
So they can blame it on their genetics, right?
It's part of it, absolutely. Our genetics certainly influence that. And so when you understand that, then you can change your nutritional environment to make sure that you have the right amount of amino acid precursors around to make sure that you thrive both under a stressful situation and under a day-to-day situation. So the MAO ones that you asked about, are similar. MAO is involved in, most of us have probably heard of old-fashioned antidepressants called MAO inhibitors. And so those stop that particular enzyme from working. And so polymorphisms in one versus the other also affect all of those neuroactive amines, including serotonin. So mutations in those fine-tune our understanding of who's going to respond how to different psychoactive medications, and also some of the anti-dementia medications work on those pathways. So in my practice, I use that information to fine-tune what medications are appropriate for which patients.
And then finally, MTRR.
MTRR is one of the other genes that's involved in homocysteine recycling. I consider it one of the more minor ones, and it plays some role in how we use B12 and folate, but I consider it a minor player. It plays a key role in passing into some other patient pathways that involve cystathionine beta synthase, which we probably won't get into tonight, but consider it for the purposes of a 101 lesson, consider it another player in the methylation pathways.
Cool. Cool. Well, this was, I feel like this part was the most fun, maybe because I'm looking at my genetic report and you're talking about it. And I know you offered to look at it for me once. I still need to take you up on that. So I actually want to go back for a second because, you know, when I made the comment about, well, we can blame, you know, like the SAT reaction to our genetics, but you said we can change those things. Can you maybe give an example, maybe in your practice with a patient or maybe in yourself where you, you know, you found a mutation and then you adjusted whatever it is, like giving certain amino acids or taking something away or something dietary to actually affect the expression of that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually a great segue into the research that we've been doing, because I started doing this in my practice, namely substituting regular B vitamins for methylated forms of methylfolate and B12. And pardon me, that's my dog there doing a little noise in the background. So I started making those substitutions in their simple B vitamins, and I was pretty shocked at the response. And so it inspired me to put on my researcher hat, and we conducted a couple clinical trials, and we heard just miraculous stories from patients who have experienced changes in all sorts of health, but especially their mental health and their energy, which is relevant to you. Mm-hmm. When they make changes in their in the types of B vitamins that we give them in terms of methylating their B vitamins.
So do you have a specific example from a patient or for someone in your study maybe?
Yeah, I've had, you know, one of the more dramatic cases that come to mind was a little boy, a four-year-old boy who was brought to me by his parents with kind of some autistic spectrum type symptoms. He had some stim behavior, some repetitive behaviors. He had a hard time making eye contact. He had a hard time focusing. And what was interesting was that mom, who brought him in, had some of the same behaviors. She certainly wouldn't have, I think, acknowledged it herself, but mid-conversation, she would kind of like look off and drift off and not quite follow the conversation, and I'd have to repeat myself. And she was very unfocused. And so we ran the child's genetics and found out that he had a homozygous mutation in MTHFR. And we started treating him with injectable methylfolate, with injectable methyl B12. And within 3 days, the child was making eye contact. His vocabulary was increasing several words within 3 days. Within a couple weeks, his vocabulary was up like 20 plus words. And he was focusing. The stim behaviors dropped off. And the father, on the return visit, mom and dad came in, and they were both astonished at it. And I broached the subject. I said, you know, your son got these genes from you guys, and so chances are you guys have a mutation here in your MTHFR. I think it'd be worth testing and treating in your situation. And the husband turned to his wife and he said, he got them from you. I see the similarity. He saw the same thing I did. And they said, yes, we want to get tested, but we want to start treating her right away. And she was a little bit hesitant because of those behaviors, you know, because she was having a little bit of a hard time focusing and holding a thought. But she agreed to give it a try on her husband's insistence, and she had a dramatic turnaround as well. And so that was certainly the case that really sparked my attention. And in our research study, we saw people have responses in everything from accelerating their stroke recovery to turning around lifelong depression, to getting rid of myalgias, to resolving fatigue, to getting rid of digestive complaints. It really is pretty miraculous, the types of symptom improvement that patients report when their MTHFR polymorphisms are appropriately treated with activated B vitamins.
That's really amazing. And you mentioned that you used injectable 5-MTHF and methyl B12 with them. Can you get the same results giving someone oral B12 or 5-MTHF?
Sometimes you can. It's definitely slower. It definitely is more subtle. It takes a little bit longer when I use oral forms. Sometimes I use high potency sublingual forms that we can put under the tongue and get directly into circulation that way. That seems to be a nice intermediary for people who aren't willing or aren't able to do intramuscular injections. So we certainly see the full range. And sometimes it's super simple. Sometimes just switching out somebody's multivitamin to one that has methylfolate and methylcobalamin can be enough if they have subtle fatigue and they don't have any further complications like elevated homocysteine. But in people with a high degree of symptomatology, in your case, you know, those people who have intractable fatigue, with the people that you talk to on your podcasts, I really see pretty dramatic responses with the injectables.
That's awesome. So I actually want to back up a little bit because you mentioned some of your study, but I would like to talk about some of the research in general in the field. So your research study was actually published in the Journal of Clinical and Medical Genomics. But before we talk about that more, I want to talk about the overall state of epigenetics research. And I feel like with this podcast, I'm really speaking to the woman who, you know, goes online and is part of the Facebook groups about MTHFR and trying to just get help in so many different places. You go to your doctor, and the doctor, most doctors are not trained in this. Some even say that it's BS, you know, that it doesn't mean anything. So I think that it's so complicated and people are looking for answers. So what does the field of research right now in this look like?
It's really interesting. Well, a couple things that we've seen. One is that most research starts with epidemiology, right? Where we look for population level associations between something we can measure, like an MTHFR gene, and something we observe, like a high homocysteine level or a diagnosis of depression or a rate of heart attack, right? And so that type of research is great because we can look at thousands of people at once. It's not great because we're just looking at associations. We can't extrapolate cause and effect. And so the epidemiology with MTHFR has looked at a lot of different populations because things like race and ethnicity have a pretty big impact here, right? That's at a genetic level. And we've seen a wide number of associations with diseases, the stuff I was talking about previously, ranging from cardiovascular disease to cancers to depression, et cetera, et cetera. What we haven't seen, or we're just beginning to see, is research into treatment response, right? More of the clinical trials. So, what happens when we treat people or try to correct their methylfolate, either their MTHFR genes or otherwise. And so I was originally approached and asked to run some of those clinical trials. And we started looking around for what would be an appropriate dose, what would be an appropriate route. The same question you asked, you know, will oral do it or does it have to be injectable? And the data just aren't there. They're not in the literature. And so we said, well, we have to start at the beginning and we have to really understand this and do some homework, some basic research to appreciate where do we start to prepare that clinical trial. So the study that you just mentioned, the one published in the Journal of Clinical and Medical Genomics, was just that. It was a survey of patients who had been treated for MTHFR polymorphisms and what their experience had been. And that's where we heard those miracle stories for the first time and really started to get a sense of, you know, what was the difference response to oral versus injectable? You know, where did we see that response? Was it just in mood? Was it in muscle fatigue? Was it in cardiovascular outcomes? And we put this in context with the epidemiology as well. And that is really what has started to fine-tune our understanding. And I think it's important to think about the state of the research and the science in the context of what's out there on the web. I think it's a fascinating area of just sort of the state of our knowledge and science right now, and that more people are getting crowdsourced information on how they should be taking care of their own health than they are from relying on their doctors. And there's two sides to that. One, most doctors, if they're not naturopathic or integrative doctors, don't know anything about that. So their doctors aren't a great source of information. On the flip side, you know, relying exclusively on peer-to-peer information from the internet might be missing some of the nuances that we can really tease out when we look at the epidemiology and the emerging clinical trials. So in my mind, it's really exciting because it's an opportunity to acknowledge what's happening in our culture and kind of the changing state of science.
Mm-hmm. And I actually want to go back for a second. So when you were talking about all the results that people experience, can you explain what's actually going on in your cells or in the DNA to make, like, when you finally take the methylated, you know, B vitamins, what's actually going on that allows you to then, I guess, methylate better? Is that a way to say it?
Mm-hmm. You know, our research hasn't done that. That's really the basic research that comes out of, you know, in vitro and in vivo models and animal models where we can look at the level of DNA expression and see that that methylation is happening. What we can see really on a human level is only in those patients with problems with homocysteine, right? We can see whether their homocysteine is going up or down, and that gives us some sense in terms of a biometric for that. There's some speculation that we can measure the different intermediaries in methionine production, SAM and SAW, S-adenosyl methionine, and S-adenosyl, I think it's hydroxymethionine. I'd have to look in detail for what that acronym stands for. So there's some thought that those intermediaries might give us some sense of what's happening at a cellular level. But really, the where we're at right now in the research, because it's a black hole, is appreciating what happens in terms of symptom response. And that's what our current study is going, is looking at.
Mm-hmm. And I'll get to that in just a moment, because this is the cool part where people can actually be part of the next study. But in your study that was published, you said that a number of studies suggest that the increased odds ratios of disease are only observed in populations with insufficient serum folate levels. So is that implying that if you are already getting folate into your diet, or maybe your doctor should be testing for that, then maybe if you have the polymorphism, it's not as much of a problem?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that is the underlying concept in epigenetics, right? Is when we change the nutritional environment, we change the ultimate outcome of the genes. Excuse me. So somebody who has an MTHFR polymorphism but is getting plenty of methylfolate, either from green leafy vegetables or in higher doses from treatment with methylfolate, will not have symptoms associated with that. So some places in the world have very low folic acid intake or have high intakes of folic acid, but they're not able to convert it to methylfolate, such as happens in the U.S. with our fortified food supply. So what the research has shown us is that the symptomatology of MTHFR is absolutely tied with folate status, and looking at folate in the blood, in the serum, is very different than looking at RBC folate or the intracellular folate. So if you have an MTHFR problem, it appears that even if you have lots of folic acid circulating in your blood, you're not necessarily able to get that intracellular where your DNA can use it to change the genetic expression.
This is all so interesting. So you are actually recruiting patients right now for your next study. So please do share. And I hope that somebody listening is interested and this resonates with you.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity for patients who are interested in finding out what the impact of these possible treatments are for their own genetics to get involved. People who are interested can send us an email at research@epigeneticsrx.com. And who we're looking for are people who have genetic polymorphisms and their doctors are recommending methylated nutrients for them. So that could be either the oral ones or sublingual ones or prescription ones. And for people who don't know how to find a doctor who can prescribe those for them, they should also send us a note at research@epigeneticsrx, and we can help connect them up with physicians who are trained in that area. And so what we're looking for is people who have not been treated with these forms of B vitamins already, who are willing to complete an online survey about how they feel now before treatment. And then they will begin prescription treatment, and we will hear how they're doing in a week, and in a month, and in 3 months, and in a year. And
Very
so it's a
cool.
pretty exciting opportunity for people to really get involved and help scientists and clinicians better understand, what exact outcomes can we expect when we treat people with these genetic polymorphisms.
So if it's someone who's already taking a multi that has the methylated bees, then they wouldn't qualify.
If it's a very low dose, they would qualify, but if they're taking super physiologic doses, then they would not.
Okay. Well, that's really, really exciting. I hope that if you're listening and that's you and you want more information, I just think this is such a great opportunity. So, Erica, what's next for you? I understand that you have another study completed that's going to be published. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we've just completed our second study. The one I just told you about that we're recruiting for is actually our third study. In our second study, we talked to physicians who were experts in this field to try to understand what their protocols are when they treat patients with genetic polymorphisms. And recall, all of these are the steps that we need to take before we get to definitive clinical trials of randomizing people to treatment or not treatment. We have to understand what an appropriate dose is, what an appropriate response would look like, what a side effect would look like, and then from there we can design trials. So in the study that we've just completed and have just submitted for publication, we talked to functional medicine and integrative medicine experts and tried to understand what the what the physician best practices are in terms of treatment.
And what did you find? Did everybody kind of do similar things, or was it very different?
You know, what we found is that it was kind of all across the board. Doctors are not consistently testing. They are using doses ranging from 400 or 800 micrograms up to 5 milligrams. That's more than a tenfold variation in dose. They're doing that daily, they're doing that weekly. Some of them are tracking follow-up symptoms, some of them are not. So there's still a huge amount of variability in the field. And we're hoping that as we learn, we'll be able to feed this back to clinicians and help them understand best practices. And right now, Epigenetics RX clinician training program is probably the best place to start to understand some of those best practices, at least in terms of a expert opinion level.
Your dog
I'm
is very
gonna, I know, I'm gonna
excited.
close the door here. There we go.
So, you mentioned the Epigenetics RX doctor. So, do they follow kind of a same protocol that's based on the research that you're doing? Is that what you're saying?
That training program, yeah, absolutely is training them in some best practices protocols, and it's really training them in the science of all of these different SNPs so that they understand how to interpret and apply the science.
Cool. Well, I think that's awesome because, like I said, I know from just following the Facebook pages and talking to people that so many people are looking for help in this field and they can't often get help from their regular doctor. So here's a resource for people to find someone. How do they find a doctor trained in it?
The best place to do is to go to the Epigenetics RX website, and they can register for free as a patient member. And from there, they can access the directory of physicians who have taken the training course and have a level of expertise in the field. So it's a great resource for patients and for doctors who are seeking to learn more. It can connect them up with a great training program that they can do to really become skilled in this area.
Very cool. And then how do you get tested if somebody has, you know, doesn't know what their polymorphisms are, but they're interested?
Mm-hmm. I think the best way to get tested is to connect with a clinician through Epigenetics RX. And there are a number of clinicians who do, Skype and telemedicine type care. So if there's not one in your zip code, that doesn't mean that you can't access them. But doing testing through something like Epigenetics RX really ensures that when you get those results, you'll have somebody to walk you through them. And it helps separate all of those, as we were talking about the RS numbers, all of those ones that really are irrelevant or don't matter from the ones that really are at the epicenter of what we know about human health. Other options, of course, are to do your own genetics through 23andMe. Right now, that only gives you a report on your heredity in terms of where your ancestors came from. But with a little bit of detective work, you can download your raw data and send it to a doctor who can run it through some of their software packages and get you some similar information. Mm-hmm. But it takes a couple extra steps, and it takes a couple extra months in terms of doing that processing. So there's a timeline factor at play.
Right. And then I think with that one too, like that's the one that I'm looking at that I ran through NutraHacker, and it's pages and pages. It's like 9 or 10 pages of
right,
SNPs.
Right.
And
you still need to take it to a doctor to figure out what to do with all that information.
Right. Right. So where do you see, my final question, where do you see this field heading? Like, what do you envision over the next 5 to 10 years in these fields?
You know, I am super excited about it, Evelyn. I think it just gives us an opportunity to personalize medicine in a whole new level. We can be so precise, not just in hearing what somebody's reporting or looking at their blood values, but really understanding what's going on for them, not even at a cellular level, but at a DNA level. And when we know that, and when we know the science of epigenetics and how to change that nutritional environment around the DNA, we have every opportunity to truly change people's health. You know, your genes are not your destiny anymore. With epigenetics, we can change that environment and do it for you as an individual, not for the average person at risk, and truly change lives. And that's what our research has shown us so far. It truly does change people's lives.
That's amazing. Well, Erica, thank you so much for your time tonight and for your expertise. And I hope that if you're listening, that it wasn't too complicated. I feel like we, like Erica, tried to make it understandable. But I might even, you know, listen to this one again just to let it all sink in.
Yeah.
Because it can get a little complicated.
It does. It does. I try to keep it simple. But to be honest, I've been studying it for a number of years. And it is complex. It does require expertise. And that's why I encourage people to find clinicians who have that training and help us learn more, you know, participate in our research, you know, send us an email at research@epigeneticsrx.com and be part of it, be part of helping us understand this better.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time again. And thank you for tuning in. Remember to visit the website, epigeneticsrx.com. Also, I appreciate you subscribing to the podcast on iTunes. And if you could just take a few seconds to just rate it, or if you have a minute, you can write a review. I so appreciate it. That way we can reach more people. And next week, I'll be interviewing Rachel Pontillo. She's the author of Love Your Skin, Love Yourself. I'll talk to you then.